Thank you, Jim. Good evening. Well, I think we all know what tomorrow is. It's the eclipse. It is. I ran across some things about the eclipse that I thought I'd start my sermon with tonight. Charlemagne was the emperor of basically Europe. And when he died, his son, Louis of Bavaria, took over, became the emperor of his father's realm. He was also known as Louis the Pious because he was an adherent of the Catholic Church. And on May the 5th in the year 840, he witnessed a total eclipse in Europe. It scared him to death. Actually, within a month he was dead, and it was attributed to he couldn't get over the terror of the eclipse. So his three sons became heirs to his kingdom. Oldest one was Lothair the First. The second one was Louis the Second. And the third one was Charles the Bald. And they started arguing over who was in charge and who got what and everything. And it got pretty bad, I guess, because by the time 843 rolled around, they had agreed to negotiate. And in 843, they had the Treaty of Verdun that they signed. And the Treaty of Verdun is where Germany, France, and Italy came from. All because somebody got scared to death because of an eclipse. Because he didn't know. The Asians, back in those times, whenever they'd have an eclipse, they learned that if they shot flaming arrows at it, it'd come back. They figured the sun went out, so they were going to relight it. Worked every time. That's how people took care of things back then. Because they didn't know. People haven't changed. They still invent stuff when they don't know. The difference is with what we have for communications today, what we have for the media, especially with this thing called the internet, well, there are just all kinds of information available at everybody's fingertips. And it's still amazing how many people don't bother to look it up. They still make stuff up about things that they don't understand. That's not new. Look at your scriptures. Look what's in the Old Testament about things that people did because they didn't understand. Jesus Christ comes. He knows. Should know. He helped create it along with his Father in heaven. And he knew how we were created, I guess you'd say, and what we were made up of, and what made us tick, and what damaged us, and therefore damaged each other. The first of the Bible, the first five books, I guess you'd say, of the Old Testament, they laid out what makes us civilized people. They made the rules. They laid down the rules. God caused Moses to write down the rules to what made a person civilized. Pretty complete, very complete, very basic, very complete. And when you do it correctly, it works. But man, being man, decides that he knows better a lot of times, that he has more wisdom, he has more logic, or he just plain doesn't like the way it's worded. So he adapts or adopts or ignores. And then it doesn't work. You can always tell, or I've got to the point, I guess you'd say, I could always tell when you read the histories about peoples and they've gotten some kind of information about the scriptures, about God's laws, because you call them civilized. In our country, in our history, the five civilized tribes down in the southeast, how did they become civilized? Had to have information. I think they got it from the plates. Because if you take a look at our archaeological history down there, and then you take a look at what's in Alma, there was a trade route that went from Yucatan to Canada. Archaeologically, they've established that with what they found in digs. They have found Mayan artifacts here and in Canada, and Canadian artifacts here and in Yucatan, and it goes on down into South America. Mentions ships. I think it's the 20th chapter of Alma. There was a man down there early on that became aware that some of these tribes were acting more civilized than others. He became interested in that, so he was an Indian trader, and so while he was traveling around plying his trade, he got to taking notes, observing and taking notes and stuff. And he became convinced that they knew something about the Old Testament. He found 23 things in the Old Testament that various tribes down there were practicing that were in the Old Testament, like, and this is just a simple one, if a man and a woman get married, a young man and a woman get married, for the first year he stays home, he doesn't go to war. Simple practice. They did it. There's 22 others. The man's name is James Adair. He wrote a book on it after he retired. He wrote the book in 1740 called Out of the Flames. The Cherokee printed. That's where I got the book. Printed in Tulsa. They knew something that their neighboring tribes didn't know, and it changed their behavior. In South America, there was a man named Simon Bolivar. I think he was born in Venezuela, I think. I'm not going to stand on that. But he grew up in a privileged family down there. He went to Europe to study. At that time, South America was under the yoke of the Spaniards. While in Europe studying, he became a big fan of our democracy here. He was a big fan of the United States democracy and the Constitution and all of this stuff. So he decided to do something about it. So he went back to South America, short story, brought up an army, threw off the Spaniards, set up countries, wrote them out constitutions for democracy, and said, here you are. Only problem is none of them worked. I mean, he went after all of the republic stuff and the votes and the districts and the representation and all of the things that he just forgot to put the things in the scriptures in it about how to treat each other, which is the secret, makes you civilized. From the start of the Old Testament until the New Testament, the people had all the information. It was recorded by Moses on how to be civilized. And in the several thousand years or whatever it is that occurred in between, they never read it. They never read what was written. they always took the previous generation's idea of what history was and expanded on that. So they didn't read their scriptures. They didn't know. And with all the best efforts in the world, they pretty much got it wrong. And the reason I can tell you that is in Matthew, the 5th chapter. It's called a Sermon on the Mount. For generations and generations and millennia, from time immemorial back then, those people had a religion. Changed a little bit in between, I guess you'd say, Malachi and Matthew, because that's when the Pharisees came into power because of Alexander the Great. But they didn't read. They just bore down on the ceremonial stuff. And by the time that Matthew shows up, or the time, I guess you'd say, time dispensation of Matthew, as long as you did all of your ceremonies right, you were religious. Didn't make any difference what was in your heart. Just so long as you did the ceremonies right. And they still add ceremonies. And look who they looked for a Messiah. Because they got the basics wrong to begin with and then never went back and read it. But they built on that misinformation. So along comes this Jesus Christ. And it's the beginning of his ministry. He pretty much starts with the Sermon on the Mount. What do we do with the Sermon on the Mount? It's information. So how do we use this information? Do we just recite it? Say we believe it? Consider ourselves adequate? Or do we look to see what it really is supposed to do to us? Matthew, 5th chapter, 3rd verse. This is Jesus talking. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He's talking to a bunch of people. He's talking to a group of people that never heard this stuff before. You've heard it all your life. They've never heard these concepts before. Try to imagine that. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Y'all understand everything about that, don't you? You know what blessed means. See, that's the first word in each one of those subject matters, in each one of those verses. Makarios is Greek for blessed. Depends on which historian you read as to what the origin of that word is. There were some gods back then, I guess you'd say, in the pagan world that were called Makarios, because Makarios means happy, contented, blessed. Because they had everything. Well, see, that doesn't really fit the tenor or the thrust of what Jesus Christ is talking about. Another historian says that Makarios, was the name of an island off the coast of Greece. Perfect climate, perfect soil, perfect weather. Everything was agricultural back then. If You lived on Marco Rios. You had bountiful crops. Nobody went hungry. Everybody was well fed. There was no need of anything else. You were contented and you were happy. I think there's a mix of those two stories. So if you're going to be blessed with all of these things, how do we understand what each one of those things mean in our language today? It took a while for me to come up with this. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Those who realize that their way is insufficient and they want to completely follow God's instructions in all aspects of their life. They're humble. They're not lording it over somebody else. They're not egotistical. They're not greedy. Those who mourn. Those who have endured the bitter sorrow that life brings, and those who are very sorry for their own sin and unworthiness. Blessed are those that mourn. The meek, those who exercise self-control and put God's ways before their ways. Blessed are the meek. Hunger and righteousness. Those whose desire it is to completely submit themselves to God's ways, no matter what the consequences, because they want to more than anything else. They thirst after it. Were you ever real thirsty or real hungry? And how bad did you want to relieve that? That's what thirst is about. You want it more than anything else. It becomes the main thrust in what you're aiming for, what you're trying to accomplish, what you want to do. Blessed are the merciful. To be able to have complete empathy for those around us, no matter what, even if it's a gnat. Blessed are the pure in heart. Those who completely abandon their own agenda in favor of God's principles. Boy, that's hard to do, since we're the humans that are the natural enemy of God, according to what the scriptures say. Blessed are the peacemakers. In Jewish, it means doing that which is needed for the good of all. It does not mean pacifism to them. For Christ, it is those who make godly relationships. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. In the face of all the world has to dish out, they adhere to God's commandments. I don't know how many, over the decades of my life, I don't know how many study classes I've been in that have tried to figure out what these say. And the frustrating thing about it is everybody wants it to be their thought, their interpretation, and they argue over the definitions and get mad at each other. Boy, what a way to be a Christian. So I'm going to go on and with the Sermon on the Mount. You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. I'm going to skip down about four verses because he starts talking about something that is kind of what I started this talk with tonight. In verse 21, he says, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time." And then he goes on to recite one of the Ten Commandments. And then in verse 27, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time. And then in verse 31, it hath been said. Verse 33, again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time. Verse 38, ye have heard that it hath been said. Why would he do that? Why would he do that? What made him use that kind of language to start each one of those subject matters? Quite bluntly, because that's what they had heard that had been said. They hadn't read it. Nobody had read it for a long, long time. They didn't read their Torah. They carried it around the great ceremony. But if you even go today, you go to a religious bookstore, I guess you'd say, and you look in the Judaica section, you will not find any discussion about the scriptures where it says it is written. Everyone that I've ever found, and I've looked and I've looked and I've looked, says Rabbi so-and-so thinks that this is the way it is, but I say it's this way. Rabbi such and such says it's this, but I think it's that. And it never says it is written in the scriptures. It always goes back to their previous rabbi as to what he thought it meant. That's why it says, you have heard that it has been said by them of old time. Book of Mormon didn't do that. Some of it is ye have heard that it has been said of old time in the Book of Mormon. But there are several that says it is written because they had the plates. Sad part about it is they made the same mistakes. But there's a difference. There's a difference in those two sermons, I guess you'd say. And why wouldn't he teach the same sermon on two continents? Why not? What you're going to do, come over here and teach something different? No. He's going to come up with the same things to talk about because we're the same people. We were the same people that were the people back in Moses' time. We loved, we hated, we laughed, we cried, we're good, we're bad. Human nature hasn't changed. You have heard that it was said, verse 21, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. It's one of the Ten Commandments. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whoso is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. I've seen some disagreement about whether that's right or not in this church. Because they say, well, Christ wouldn't say that you can't be angry, that you can be angry with a cause. So it has to have been put in there by somebody else. Moses didn't do it because God didn't tell him to do it. Well, it's in there. It's in the scriptures 50 times in the Old and New Testament. And I didn't argue with that for a long time until I ran across something in this book. In Alma, 21st chapter. This is what I mean about not reading or not understanding what you read, or reading with a pre-agenda, I guess you'd say, on what you're going to learn. I'm going to start on page 478. Kind of a long reading, has to be, and I'm going to start with verse 128. And now that it came to pass while Amalickiah had thus been intending power by fraud and deceit, Moroni, and we know that story about how he became in charge of the Lamanites, Moroni, on the other hand, had been preparing the minds of the people to be faithful unto the Lord their God. Yea, he had been strengthening the armies of the Nephites and erecting small forts or places of resort, throwing up banks of earth round about to enclose his armies, also building walls of stone to encircle him about, round about their cities, and the borders of their lands, yea, all round about the land. And in their weakest fortifications he did place greater number of men, and thus did he fortify and strengthen the land which was possessed by the Nephites. And thus he was preparing to support their liberty, their land, their wives, their children, their peace, that they might live unto the Lord their God, that they might maintain, which was called by their enemies, the cause of Christians. Well, there's a cause. But you don't stop there. That's only, you're only about halfway through, because it sets up what is a cause and how you handle it, or how you function within it, or however you want to say that, whatever the situation dictates. And Moroni was a strong and mighty man. He was a man of perfect understanding, yea, a man that did not delight in bloodshed, a man whose soul did joy in the liberty and the freedom of his country and his brethren from bondage and slavery, yea, a man whose heart did swell with thanksgiving to his God for the many privileges and blessings which he bestowed upon his people, a man who did labor exceedingly for the welfare and safety of his people. I'm going to stop there. I'm not done reading, but I'm going to stop there. There's a word that jumped out at me there. We all want to be Christians. We've got to look out for the welfare of everybody else. What's our welfare? Who defines our welfare? Typically, we do. We decide what's to your welfare, and we act accordingly. So how do we act? All different kinds of ways. What, there are 45 people in here tonight? Bet you there's 45 different ideas on welfare, 45 different ways of doing it, given any particular circumstance. Usually we try to correct the person. It's a human emotion. But do we do it correctly, or we do it incorrectly, given the circumstances? That welfare and safety of his people, you can really go a long ways with defining that. It all depends on your outlook on things and what you want to accomplish with your agenda, not the agenda, especially, of the scriptures. You remember how you were supposed to go with God's way of doing things instead of your way of doing things, like he said there in the Beatitudes? Well, how do you find out that? You got to read it all. And, but first off, you got to read it instead of just come up with it. And if you do come up with it or something happens, where are you going to find it if it's true in the scriptures? I've had the Lord talk to me on many occasions. I'm not going to go into those. But I've had the Lord talk to me on many occasions. And by far, I'm not the only one, especially in this group, that that's happened to. In fact, I'm probably way back in the pack. So I believe in that concept completely. But I also know that there are denominations out there, I guess you'd say, that use that solely as their basis for doing something. When I was growing up, I had a guy in high school 2 years ahead of me. He belonged to a restoration church. And every time that he wanted to prove something, it always grew within his breast. Where'd he get that? Book of Mormon says it. I believe it. But after a while, you start thinking, boy, he sure gets a lot of swellings in his breast. And he never gave any other justification for the things. It was just that was what the Lord told him to do. If the Lord tells you to do something, he's not going to go against what's already in the scriptures. He's not going to contradict his own laws. So you should be able to go somewhere in his scriptures and find verification if it's of him. Going on, 134, yea, and he was a man who was firm in the faith of Christ. He had sworn with an oath to defend his people, his rights, his country, his religion, even to the loss of his blood. Now the Nephites were taught to defend themselves against their enemies, even to the shedding of blood, if it were necessary to preserve their cause. That wasn't the rule, that was the exception. Only when you had to and with great reluctance. That's the parameters that you use when you go about these things. You don't stop just because you ran across that word cause in verse 131. You got to read what you have to be. And that's what Moroni was in the passage after that. You got to read it. You got to read all of it. I don't think there's anything that I've ever found in the scriptures, in the Bible or the Book of Mormon, that's a great big truth that stands all by itself. It's always corroborated. And when the scholars that created the King James Version of the Bible created the King James Version of the Bible, that was one of their first rules. Any book that they put in the King James Version had to corroborate the other, what turned out to be 65 books. If it didn't, it didn't go in there. So corroboration even stayed back then. In the mouths of two or three witnesses, all things are established, as I believe the way we say it today. Same thing. And we don't throw that out the first time we come up with an emotional decision on something, whatever it is. I don't care what it is. But it has to do with our spiritual welfare, especially a group's spiritual welfare. There's always a basis for it in the scriptures if it's true. I may not like it because it may go completely against what I think is right, but I don't count. The scriptures is what counts, as long as it's read correctly. And many times that's our problem. That was the problem with the Jews back in the New Testament. They didn't want to hear all of that stuff about a new religion. They'd had the Pharisees and the Orthodox Jewish religion for centuries. They didn't want to change. That's why all this stuff in the Sermon on the Mount was so foreign to them, because it had to do with something that was in their hearts, had to do with their feelings, had to do with their perspectives and their attitudes about things. No longer could they just go out and do a bunch of ceremonies and be religious. You had to do something. You had to be nice. You had to share, don't hit. Some of the basic stuff. They started that a long time ago. If you go to 2 Kings, I've talked about this before. If you go to 2 Kings, and let me see here, 22nd chapter of Kings. I ran into a group one time that told me that Kings was pretty much, 1 and 2 Kings is pretty much useless, because why should you have to memorize who the kings were and what order they were in and when they lived and when they died? And I said, if that's all you get out of Kings, yeah, you're wasting your time, because that's not what Kings and 1 and 2 Kings is about. It's about what people did right and what people did wrong and their consequences. It starts off in the 22nd chapter of Kings, 2 Kings. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name is Jedidah, and the daughter of Abdiah of Boscath. And then it says, and he did that which is right in the sight of the Lord, and walked all the way of David his father, and turned not aside to the right hand nor to the left. And I always took that for a long time to understand, until I read this chapter, that he was a follower of God, and that he knew the things of God. But you get on down in the story, and that's not true. And instead of reading, because this thing's going to go for two more chapters, I'm not going to read these two chapters and put you all to sleep. But basically, in this church today, there were things that had to be done to the church building so they get the people in there to fix it. And then the bishops had to pay for it. Now, I've covered the first seven verses right there. And it says, and then Hilkiah the high priest said unto Shaphan the scribe, that's who Shaphan went to get the check to pay the workmen, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. The last time, as far as I can find out in these chapters of 2 Kings, the last time that book of the law had anything to do with anything was 55 years before that. And in 55 years, they hadn't heard anything about the book of the law. The book of the law being probably Leviticus and Deuteronomy, or maybe all five of the first books, which teaches you how to be civilized. A child of God. If you haven't read it, you ought to read it. It tells you how to be a farmer, tells you how to be a rancher, tells you how to what charity really is, tells you how to treat your wife, how you treat your kids, how to treat your boss. Goes through a whole bunch of things, a lot of which we still do. We still do a ton of that stuff. Even in business today, we do a ton of that stuff that's in the Old Testament. So anyway, Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan. Shaphan read it. He takes it to Josiah the king. He reads it to the king. The king he rinsed his clothes and all of that stuff that they did back then, because he'd never heard of this stuff before. But he was, what did it say? He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. But he never heard this stuff. So he goes through his own process by which he decides that this book is valid. And that's the rest of that chapter. And then you get over into chapter 23. Now, this is the house of the Lord. Better way of saying it, the houses of the Lord, because the more you read, the more you find out that this was countrywide. It wasn't just a building. It was an organization. And it was called the House of the Lord. And by the time Josiah gets done reading this book of the law, he knows what he has to do. So he starts doing it. These are the things that they invented for religious ceremonies in the house of the Lord. How did they do that? Probably took a lot of time, a lot of deliberation, a lot of arguing, a lot of things, without having something to read, without having the foundation of the laws of God. And they come up with this stuff. Verse 4 in chapter 23. I'm not going to read all of them. I'm just going to give you a few. And the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest and the priests of the second order and the keepers of the door functions now to bring forth out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal, for the grove, for all the hosts of heaven. And he burned them without Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried the ashes of them into Bethel. And he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah, in the same places around about Jerusalem, them also that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the planets, and to all the host of heaven. And he brought out of the grove from the house of the Lord without Jerusalem and unto the brook of Kidron, and burned it at the brook Kidron, and stamped it to small powder, and cast the powder thereon upon the graves of the children of the people. And I just, what's that? Three verses. And it goes on for the rest of the chapter. Those were practices that they instituted in the house of the Lord because they hadn't read what the Lord told them to do about running the house of the Lord. They invented it because they hadn't read. That's my point. They hadn't read it. They hadn't read it correctly. How do you read it correctly? What do we practice? What do we believe in right after baptism? What's the very next thing that you see after a person is immersed? They have the hands laid on them for the reception of the Holy Ghost. That's not a ceremony. That's not just something you do. Without that Holy Ghost to sit on your shoulder and talk in your ear to you, you don't understand anything. Had a group, came as a group from another church, had had the Book of Mormon all their lives. They get into this church. I go up there to hold services for them or with them. And all they want to do is study. And it's the first, out of this group, out of this other church, I had met people in this church before, in this group. And the minute that I said anything that was contrary to what they wanted to believe, out the door I went, as far as they were concerned. This group would tell me what they believed. I said, let's look it up. When they didn't find it, they dumped it. Might have taken them 3 or 4 hours, might have taken them a half a day, but once they were convinced by the scriptures that what we say we believe is true, they dumped it. They got rid of that baggage. After about 3 days of this, the second time I was up there, they said, you know, we've had the Book of Mormon all our lives, but this is the first time we ever understood it. Wonder why. That's how important the Holy Ghost is. Something that we take almost for granted, maybe. Hope not, maybe. Because it's an object, it's an image, it's a thought, it's just a part of what we believe. It's super important. It's super important. The influence of the Holy Ghost in our lives. Because He tells you things that you can't learn otherwise. I don't care if you're reading the same page as somebody else. And those people proved it to me. I had never come up with, I never run into that before where it was just so obvious about the Holy Ghost. I don't think there's a book in the Bible. I don't think there's a book in the Book of Mormon that's not useful. Maybe we have our own favorite books, or maybe our own favorite passages in these books. I fall into that trap, and I think I know better. I want to think that I know better, because when I have 8 or 10 passages I like and I run with those, I leave all the rest of them out. And I'm leaving stuff out that I should be understanding, because I shouldn't just be reading it. I should be getting it to where I can understand it and then be able to function within those parameters. And some of it, especially if you're used to having, say, I'm just going to pick as an example, say you like Romans. And that's all you read is Romans. Well, there's nothing wrong with reading Romans, but Romans isn't all of it. If it was, it'd be the only thing in the Bible. You got to have the depth, and you got to have the perceptions that come with reading all the rest of it to put it in its proper context, with the instructions of the Holy Ghost. King Benjamin, who is, I guess you'd say, my favorite king, didn't act like a king at all, as we know. He made his own living. He didn't live off the backs of his subjects. They adored him. They prospered under him. That doesn't mean they all got rich. That means that they prospered under him. They were blessed. That's another good example, but that's the whole chapter in that book, in the Book of Mormon, to read for our instructions, for our benefit, for me getting my toes stepped on in places. Because none of us do it all completely. None of us do it all right. That's why the Lord in his wisdom put all of these ministry up here. So you get all other perspectives. I was always amazed sitting out there, especially years ago, when you'd sit there and you'd see four or five people taking notes of the sermon, and they'd peek over the shoulder and look up to see what they were writing. And they could be sitting next to each other hearing the same sermon and writing different things down. So that's how varied our perspectives are about things. And we have to take that into account. You know, what's the ironclad thing that we can all rely on as being ironclad? There's no two ways about it. And it's just two words: don't sin. And then it starts getting murkier from there the further you go in the definitions of it. But the thing about it is, and you got to understand what sin is and how you do it and how we usually value our wisdom and our logic above the things that are in the scriptures, because we know better. I've lived for a long time. I know all of these things. I've been around the horn. But we don't. And we do exactly what people have done down through the ages. We tend to tailor things to make ourselves feel comfortable about our behavior and our perspectives. And that really doesn't work. One of the biggest, I'm going to say in the 1600s, I think it was, or maybe it was the 1700s, one of the biggest fields for promise in furthering Protestantism, I guess you'd say, or Christianity, was China. And Europe had something like 1,400 missionaries in China. And both things were going great guns over there. They really was. They were making a lot of headway. And then some Chinese man decided to go rogue on him, I guess you'd say. And he had convinced himself that he was Jesus Christ's brother. This is true now. And he was a silver-tongued sort. And he convinced a huge amount of people that he was Jesus Christ's brother. And he had a bone to pick with the Chinese government. So he was channeling all of these people into resisting the Chinese government to the point of establishing his own army. And he was winning because he was good at it. And just about the time they thought all was lost, that the Chinese government thought all was lost, he gets food poisoning and dies. And there went his campaign. And it didn't take long for the Chinese government to overcome his army. And then to make sure that it never happened again, they kicked out all of the missionaries, all the Protestant missionaries out of China and forbade Christianity in China. And Mao Tse-tung, when he became the dictator over there, I guess you'd say, reinforced that. Well, he's gone. And when he left, for some reason, the Chinese government did what this government did when we formed the United States of America. They assigned committees to research civilizations and to see what they did and what was it they did right and what was it they did wrong. And they assigned a committee to the United States of America. And each one of these organizations or each one of these nations that was investigated with, they knew that this, that the committees were doing this from China. They would each get a report of what they found. The committee that investigated the United States basically said, we studied your economics and that's not the reason you're great. We studied your weapons, and that's not the reason you're great. We studied your politics, and we find that's not the reason you're great. The reason you're a great, strong nation is that you're Christians. That's China. Largest printing press, or the most active printing press, I guess you'd say, in the world right now is in China that prints Bibles. They print 40 million a year in Mandarin Chinese. There's a huge footprint, I guess you'd say, of Protestantism in China nowadays. And it's starting to show. You take a look at what's going on over there, it's starting to show. They're starting to do the things in advancing that we have done. But what are those things? There's thousands of religions. There's thousands of denominations out there. Which one's right? Well, you know, what are we going to say? We are, like they all do. If they didn't think they were right, they wouldn't be doing it. But what made this country great? The Church of Christ Temple Lot? It didn't start till 1830 as an organization. What made this country great? The laws of God and how they're used and how they're interpreted and how they're obeyed with all the warts, and boy, do we ever have warts, especially anymore. That's what makes things prosper. Is the laws of God. Look at all of the movements today to get rid of that and to do all the humanitarian things and to do all of these things that a society says is progressive, which is a big misuse of that word. When the things that make us prosper as individuals and the things that make us prosper as groups and makes us prosper as a nation is in these books. We need to get back to those books and we need to read them and we need to read all of it, not just a passage or a chapter or a book, to see how it all fits together so we have some depth to what we do. Like having a cause and how to use a cause and what it takes for a person to successfully use a cause, like I read. That's just one example, but I thought it was a pretty good one. I'm going to watch Eclipse tomorrow. Hope it doesn't scare me to death. I'm going to leave my bows and arrows at home because I know better. I just know better. But that's an act of God. if you take it for what it is and leave it at that, it's just another thing that he's given us. Doesn't change, isn't going to change a big thing. I've heard a couple of sermons about how it's going to be all catastrophic and all of this. And, you know, the solar system's going to fail because, you know, the solar panel system's going to fail and all of this. It's not. You know, kind of like it's a repetition of Y2K when all the paranoia posses, I call them, tuned up and all this disaster is going to happen. It's not. So enjoy for what it is, but the most important thing is don't ever forget to read your scriptures and read all of them and ask the Holy Spirit to tell you what it means. Thank you.